Hello and welcome to Modern American Diplomacy, a podcast exploring the lives and contributions of America's most accomplished diplomats. I'm Ben Reams, recording in Washington, D.C. with my colleague Eva Mahari. Today we're honored to welcome Ambassador Ronald Newman, the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. He served as ambassador three times to Algeria, then Bahrain, and finally Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007. He also served at our embassy in Iraq as our chief liaison to the multinational force there in 2004. Ambassador Newman is also the author of two books, studied history and political science, and earned a Bronze Star during his service in Vietnam. Quick intro for Eva. She's a cultural diplomacy and development specialist who has worked on Afghanistan since 2009, completed her PhD on cultural heritage, politics, and diplomacy in Afghanistan, and is now an editor at the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training. One quick disclaimer for me, as a Foreign Service officer, I'm doing this interview in my personal capacity, so any views I happen to express are my own and not necessarily those of the U.S. government. Ambassador Newman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure to be with you. Eva.
So I'd like to turn and give Eva the first go.
The primary mission of ADST is to collect oral histories of American diplomats, and we are privileged to have material from your father, who was also a three-time U.S. ambassador. I wanted to start by asking a question about his history. Your father recalled eloquently how he was politically active against the Nazi regime in his native Austria and then sent to a concentration camp. He wrote that this horrific experience helped him to, and I quote, appraise people for what they were, not for their position or rank, which he thought served him well in his later diplomatic career. So I'd like to know, of the lessons your father shared from his extraordinary life, what lessons most shaped and served you as a diplomat, would you say, and that you might pass on to young Foreign Service officers?
Wow. I think one would be that he had a very good way of listening to people, just a fundamental piece of diplomacy, listening enough to understand others. And was very good at figuring out how to phrase things to elicit information that he wanted. In fact, he and I used to joke about the sometimes indirect methods. And I asked him once, do you think either one of us could learn to go from one point to another in a straight line? And he looked at me somewhat quizzically, and after a moment, he said, why learn bad habits? Which was a perfectly clear answer, but it did not violate the principle. So I learned a lot that way.
So I have a question also going back to history and your father and your entry into the Foreign Service by way of Vietnam and your experience there as an infantry officer. This is a plug for ADST and our oral histories, but I was reading some of your oral history there, and there's all kinds of fascinating tidbits about like meeting John Paul Vann, who's this famous figure, and being in the ambassador's residence after being pulled off of a mountain because your father's passing through on his way back to Afghanistan. Just great color. And I'd also like to mention that you're the only U.S. ambassador that can make an IED out of Claymore Mines mentioned in there. Just a curious factoid. But what I wanted to ask about that experience is, what did Vietnam and the war teach you about being, and I'm going to characterize you, sir, hopefully accurately, but being questioning and very discerning about the answers that you get? Was there anything in your Vietnam experience that shaped you as a future diplomat, do you think?
Certainly one thing I have learned is the need to have multiple sources to confirm information. But is this something I learned in Vietnam? Some of that is the fact that my BA was in history. Hmm. I had some fairly rigorous teaching about being an historian and the need to look at sources and say, is the person close in fact? Is he a personal observer of what he saw? Is he writing third hand? Is he writing close in time or a century later? And those are exactly the same questions that as a political officer you need to ask. The other is, I suppose, the development of some kind of confidence in your own judgment, not necessarily to just rule over things, but if you have a question, to make sure you explore it. I had an incident in Algeria where the CIA station came in with a report that a plane had landed and been shot up at the airport. It had been so shot up that it had to deploy a drag chute to land. And this was pretty concerning for our security. But I doubted this report because I wasn't hearing it from any place else. It wasn't credible that you wouldn't have other people talking about something like that. So I insisted on holding the report, even though they felt the source was just impeccable, until our air attaché got back, and he'd been a C-130 navigator. So I showed him this, and he said, well, I don't know anything about the report, but I know that C-130s don't have drag chutes. So he said, trust your instincts. Not trust them just to make decisions, but trust them to ask questions.
Okay. I'd like to ask a follow-up on that because it triggered a memory that I had reading something else that you wrote your first days, I think, as ambassador to Afghanistan. So this is jumping way ahead. You did a walk around the perimeter to see for yourself what things looked like. And the way that you're talking about how we work with our intelligence colleagues. Also, I've always wanted in this podcast to talk more about diplomatic security and what they do to help us. But I'd like to know your thoughts about what has been a good relationship for you with diplomatic security, because you talk a lot about those professionals in your work and you've had three different ambassadorships. So what is an example of working that you think is a positive?
I would say, first of all, that I have had really excellent relations with the diplomatic security officers that have been the what we call the regional security officers. Generally, I've found that if you tell them what you're trying to do, they can help you figure out how to do it safely. If the question is always reduced to, can I do this today, that's much harder. Mm-hmm. I would say my relations with security officers probably evolved over time. When I went to Algeria, I was very conscious of being a first-time ambassador and very careful about what I pushed on. By the time I went to Afghanistan, I was a grumpy third-time ambassador in my third critical threat post. And I could say to my security officer, look, your job is to enable me to do my job safely. If I think you are doing that, then when you come through the door and tell me you really don't want me to do something, I'll really listen to you. If you tell me all the time, no, I'll be my own security officer and I'll make those decisions myself. Yeah. But having said that, I found the people I worked with extremely understanding about that and very creative. But they also knew that I had their back.
Right.
Okay, before we get too far ahead, I want to jump back to Vietnam and do another plug for ADST. We have a number of histories from Foreign Service officers who witnessed the fall and evacuation of Saigon in 1975. And I found that there were really striking parallels between Saigon and the fall and evacuation of Kabul this August, from lack of awareness in the leadership to denial about what events were about to transpire, even down to devastating details like people clinging to planes. I can't help but feel that there were critical lessons that should have been learned from Saigon and potentially applied to Afghanistan. So given your experience in both wars, I wonder if you would reflect on the differences and similarities of these events as you see them. And how do we retain that institutional knowledge in the U.S. government so that tragic episodes like this aren't destined to repeat themselves?
I wish I knew the answer to the second question. Basically, I think I have seen far more lessons observed than lessons learned, especially when they're separated by generations of time. Now, there are differences, I think, that are really important in the two wars. Afghanistan was an insurgency. Vietnam was essentially a conventional conflict between two states, North and South Vietnam, fought with unconventional tactics. The Saigon, the South Vietnamese army, didn't totally fall apart the way the Afghan forces did, but they were overrun. There were 20 divisions that came south from North Vietnam, tank attacks. In South Vietnam, you had leadership on the ground in our ambassador who was really denying the case. I don't think that was the case in Afghanistan. I think there was a misperception about how well the Afghan army would hold. I don't understand the decision. I oppose it bitterly. I thought it was a stupid decision that we didn't have to have the disaster we had. I don't think it was unpredictable that things would go rapidly. In fact, I was back in Kabul in July, about 6 weeks before the fall. And when I came back, I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. And I said, if the cities start to go, it can go very quickly and we can have a very messy evacuation. And I would have preferred not to be quite so right. But there was a reflection which others had as well. It was based on Afghan history. I think we were complicit in a way in both deteriorations, but in very different fashion. In Vietnam, it was the issue that the Congress cut off the funding. So Vietnamese army was running out of bullets and equipment because they had no money to buy it. In Afghanistan, it was the process of undercutting the morale of the forces, first through the withdrawal agreement signed under the Trump administration, and then Biden declaring not just that we were leaving, but declaring that we would continue to support Afghanistan and having no plan to do so and no idea how they were going to do so.
So this is a shift away from Afghanistan. Looking at your career, you served in South and Central Asia, SCA as we call it, but also NEA.
People think of me nowadays in association with Afghanistan. And in fact, I spent 22 years of my career either working in or on the issues of the Persian Gulf.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks of me as a Gulf person anymore.
Right. And actually put together, it's kind of like your focus has been the Muslim world in a lot of ways. So just picking one that I find interesting, you're one of the few diplomats that I could name or think of that served in Iran from 1973-ish to 76 in Tabriz, nonetheless, not even the capital. So I'm just curious what that was like for you.
Oh, it was glorious. I mean, first of all, I went up as the vice consul at a two-person post, but I was the administrative consular and kind of the political officer. And after a year, I became the principal officer. So I'm running my own post. I've got 13 locals, my second assignment in the Foreign Service.
Oh, that's great.
All the Kurdish areas of the Iran-Iraq border were part of our consular district. And the Kurdish rebellion in Iraq in 1974 kicked off. So I started spending about a week out of every month traveling mostly up and down the frontier reporting on what was going on.
Wow.
And I'd had some Persian training, and I'd been lazy, used an interpreter. And once the war started, it was very apparent after my first trip that people would talk a lot more if I didn't have an interpreter, because they never knew who the interpreter really reported to. So I cut the umbilical cord and worked on my Farsi and traveled without an interpreter. In some places, I'd get nothing. I would go out to the governor at Pir and Shar. He wouldn't tell me anything. I'd go out and see him every trip just so it wasn't clear that the governor down in Sardasht would talk to me a great deal. So, I mean, culturally, it was a great trip. Tabriz was not overrun by foreigners the way Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz were, so that most of our friends were Iranian or Americans or expats married to Iranians. It was us. There was a Turkish consulate general, and there were British and French information officers. That was it for the diplomatic community, and a bunch of Russians that were rebuilding the railway up the Russian border who probably had some other agendas. So it was the kind of tour you'd love to have, your own post, pre-email. If I went traveling, there was no way of contacting me. I had a radio. I could talk to Tehran on a scratchy telephone line. And I'd try to time my trips so that I'd come back with 2 or 3 days to write and then send the cables down by pouch and let Tehran send them out. Otherwise, I had to encode them myself, which was laborious. So this was
amazing.
A world out of another time of diplomacy. And Iran's culturally enormously rich. I like Iranians as people.
Yeah. What was it like for your family?
My wife was very busy. In those days, we had both a K through 5 school and a preschool that were functioning in the consulate. So we had all the kids there in this other wing of the consulate. And my predecessor's wife had started a kindergarten, which we needed for our young son. And the only way to keep the preschool going when they left was my wife bought it and ran it. So she was the preschool director for the next 2 years. And, of course, very involved in community stuff and shopping. And she was so well known in the bazaar that they'd go in and, well, just take this carpet home and try it for a week and see if you like it. So she had a great time.
Jumping back across the border to Afghanistan, and you were doing numerous op-eds and podcasts this summer, which, as you said, unfortunately proved prescient. And in an article this month for Atlantic Council with a number of other diplomats and military figures, you've advocated for the U.S. government to take action as the Afghan population faces severe economic hardship owing to the lack of aid, sanctions, and drought, everything that we're hearing on the news right now. I mean, as you know, we are hearing these heart-wrenching stories about Afghan families having to choose to sell their daughters right now. And 90% of the population below the poverty line, or is expected to be below the poverty line in the next year and a half. So I'd like to know your particular views on the way forward. Should the U.S. government engage with the Taliban, or do we work around them, and in what ways?
Well, we already are engaging with them, talking to them in Doha, and we have to engage. I think we can separate engagement from recognition. I think the Biden administration is correct not to release the frozen assets. There are huge needs, questions about terrorism, as well as human rights in Afghanistan. But there is also a major humanitarian crisis impending. There are a lot of other things we need to be doing, government aid to private NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and the UN and their agencies to move aid. And we need to figure out how to let the banking system function because our sanctions on the banking system are preventing Afghans who have money from getting at their money. They're preventing people from doing basic business. This isn't the Taliban. This is just Afghan citizens. If they can't do business, they can't make money, they can't feed themselves, the humanitarian crisis gets worse. There is no perfect solution. Whatever you do, there's going to be some leakage. But if they don't get on with a decision, then people will die. The other problem is, and this is more conjectural, I'm speaking only for myself, not for the American Academy of Diplomacy, I think they just wish Afghanistan would go away, and it won't go away. But the result is that we're not engaging with a great deal of vision. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be able to have a vision for a long time. It's going to take a while for the Taliban to settle down. If they do, they may not be able to govern. There's a lot of challenges to them. Any progress is going to be very, very slow. But if we have a longer-term policy, I have not heard it articulated.
Looking at your assignments, it seems like you have seen this dynamic as much as anyone, which is what we call the 10,000-mile screwdriver. And that's the problem of the far-flung embassy on the one hand and the capital on the other, and the principal agent problems that are inherent in that. And it just seems that Afghanistan, from my experience there and what I read in your book, is just like a masterclass in that problem and trying to communicate between both sides. For example, you talked about this instance at that time. You were working to help the government of President Karzai, but also put drug traffickers in prison, and how those goals came in conflict. And this is an example of one of those things that is very hard to explain to people, the different universes that we sometimes operate in. So I was wondering if there are things that you learned in your career, tactics or approaches, strategies for how to bridge that disconnect between what it's like, the reality on the ground or in the field, and how DC envisages policy playing out or grand strategies.
It's not a new problem. There's a book by the former CIA director, Bill Colby, about Vietnam. He spent about 15 years off and on associated with it. And at one point, he refers to Washington as having the view that the reason Vietnam was failing was because the Vietnamese were incapable of understanding and applying the brilliant solutions designed in Washington. I'm sure that somewhere there are wax tablets engraved with some Roman governor protesting that Rome doesn't understand the need to treat a Germanic chieftain properly.
Of course.
There's an imperial hubris. I don't think there's any one solution. I mean, there are a couple of things. One is that you need to leave people in place on the ground long enough to build up real expertise. But the other problem is, of course, the capitals don't necessarily respect expertise. And in fact, they can question whether the expert is too close to the local host government. So you have to be able to both demonstrate that you are perfectly capable of having a heavy hand with your hosts at the same time that you're explaining to Washington. There's no simple solution. One has to pay a great deal of attention to Washington. One has to work Washington as assiduously as you work the foreign government.
And were there ways that you did that? For example, when you had in-country visits, or we call them CODELs and staff DELs, or when you would have to go out on consultations back to D.C.?
I certainly did those things. They're certainly necessary. Whether they're sufficient is another question. CODELs, I always made sure that we had a good substantive embassy briefing, even if they just wanted to jump in cars and go see troops, because this was our chance to explain to them some of the ground realities. And generally, they reacted quite well. Washington, yes, get back fairly frequently and go see a lot of people. And don't assume that because you're the ambassador, you can pronounce and people will believe you. This takes a lot of selling. Afghanistan was a little easier. In one respect, was when I went out, I asked Secretary Rice, how do you want me to report to you? And she said, call me. Call me once a week. And those kind of calls would be maybe 10 minutes. So I needed to think very carefully about how I was going to use that time. But it's an endless issue of how do you gain understanding? How do you gain respect for your views? How do you tell somebody else that their views, while entirely intelligent, aren't going to work? That just takes endless work and patience and studying people, not just studying your local, your host government, but studying your Washington counterparts. The starting point is to understand that you have to work Washington just as hard as you work the locals. And that means also having your own network, your country desk, your country director, your deputy assistant secretary, who are alerting you one Academy study, we recommended that in addition to the so-called A100, the introductory course, that there be a six-month practicum where people would spend 4 days a week working a substantive job and 1 day a week in training, because you have to understand the building, because that's your client. If you don't know what your client wants, it's very difficult to give them satisfaction.
I'd like to pick back up on the theme of the fate of Afghan women for a moment. You're on the board of SOLA, the School of Leadership in Afghanistan, where I taught many years ago, and I'm happy to note, I think they're still in Rwanda, right?
They're in Rwanda.
Much sunnier and beautiful and safer, I think, than their previous situation. And as an historical note, I noted that your mom actually set up some girls' schools as well in Kabul when she was there. So I guess it's a bit of a family tradition to support this. But as you know, SOLA is one of the many institutions that's helped educate a generation and empower young women since 2001. So I'm curious to know what you think the U.S. should be doing to further support Afghan girls. How do we continue to help empower them now that they're scattered around the world?
We can certainly help women that are outside, girls that are outside Afghanistan, get educations. What we don't have much way of doing is helping them be leaders in Afghanistan. Now, along with the international community, we can keep pressure on the Taliban for women's education, which we should do. I think partly one's going to have to start with an understanding that if the question is how do you ensure women are well-treated in Afghanistan, the answer is we can't. We can work toward it. We cannot ensure it. And if the policy is going to be rated on whether it works that way, you're probably going to have unrealistic goals because there's a limit to what we can do. Now, we should push on that limit. We can certainly push, for instance, say, restricting aid if the Taliban don't let women be engaged in the delivery of aid, because if women are not engaged, it won't get to women. On the other hand, if the Taliban closed down girls' schools, does that mean you withhold aid, which may mean people die? Probably not. And then you probably work a lot in the margin between those kind of black and white alternatives. My guess is there are going to be a lot of little deals. And I think we will have an issue ourselves that people will want to see large-scale progress. And if there's not large-scale progress, they will complain, be spoilers. But in some cases, you may find you can get limited progress if you don't talk about it very much, or you have limited progress for some kind of payoff. And that may be very difficult to talk about without ruining it. Mm. It'll be a piece of a diplomatic action, which we will have multiple goals on terrorism, on control of internal terrorist groups, on women's rights, and we'll have to pursue multiple objectives at the same time.
I've been helping with an evacuation, and I'm getting all of these incredibly desperate messages from a lot of the young women that were involved. It was across the cultural sector. And do you think there'll be more opportunities opening up to bring some of these young women to the U.S. to continue their education?
At this point, I think our general refugee policy is deplorable. We have left behind thousands of people to whom we have a primary obligation because they fought with us, and we have a legal obligation. And we're not doing very well at that. I think we have a broader obligation to people who are at high risk of danger. Mm-hmm. We have an obligation, I believe, to people who didn't work for us, but they bought into the values we preached. And that's particularly true of women who were judges and lawyers and TV producers. And it also includes a lot of men in those categories as well. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing much of anything for any of them. I'd like to see a much broader refugee population, a much broader refugee welcome.
Speaking of impressive women, you apparently charmed Afghans at your swearing-in ceremony by singing your wife's praise, which I thought was a really effective, unscripted form of soft power where they got a sense of your values and sort of a mutual appreciation. So since ADST recently contributed to a series about partners of the Foreign Service and their incredible contributions, I want to make sure to give credit where it's due here. Do you have a particular story you'd like to share about a time when your wife played an especially important role in your diplomatic efforts?
When I was in Iraq, originally the deal was that I was ambassador in Bahrain and I was asked to go to Iraq and work for Bremer. And the deal was that I would go back to Bahrain, finish my tour when we turned sovereignty back to the Iraqis. And then late one night after I'd stumbled back to my trailer, this guy, Negroponte, who was going to be ambassador in Iraq but who I'd never met, called me up and said he thought it would be a Jim Dandy idea if I'd stay on for another year as the liaison to the military. So I wasn't wild about this idea. We'd already had 3 years of separated tour when I was ambassador in Algeria, and I'd been separated then in Iraq. So I was writing back and forth with my wife. She wrote me at one point, emailing back and forth, said, "I'll support you whatever you do, but you need to realize that you have certain skills." And that really helped me make up my mind to accept and stay for another year.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, thank you for your service and for her wisdom.
Yeah, good.
And for her service.
Good woman.
And this question may get to your current position as president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. A lot of your answers remind me of how unsatisfying some of the foreign policy decisions we have to make are, and how messy and occasionally muddled. And when you're faced with choosing the least bad option, how do you think the American public understands that reality of not being able to necessarily deliver a satisfying solution to all of these problems where they might have thought America's going to come in and fix everything?
I think they're capable of understanding a great deal if you explain it properly. Properly means not reciting talking points, but explaining the logic of a policy and what you can't do or what you believe you can't do. I don't think we're very good at that. The harder the problem, the more need there is for that explanation at a top level. When you look at Afghanistan, one of the huge problems is that neither President Obama nor President Trump owned the war, even though they kept troops there.
Ava opened with a question about your father. I thought it'd be kind of fitting to close with a quote from him coming from your book on Afghanistan. "Diplomacy is a profession where you neither start what you finish nor finish what you start." So for our State Department friends and colleagues in the field or in the trenches of D.C., what can you tell them about why it is nonetheless worthwhile taking initiative, that is starting something, or examples where you have gotten a sense of accomplishment even when you weren't able to see something through to the very end?
Some of the sense of satisfaction comes from the nature of the issues you're working on. They really matter. Mm. They matter to people. They matter to the nation. Matters of national security. Matters of economic prosperity. A lot of nights I went home not necessarily happy with how something was decided. I would say in 37 years active duty, I never went home one night and wondered if what I was working on mattered. That in itself is a matter of considerable satisfaction. So there's one piece. The other is, of course, you shouldn't be discouraged because you can't fix everything yourself at one time. I mean, it's a big world. And a lot of things are very long term. And often we would be better off as a nation accepting that things are long term and working on them that way instead of trying for short term solutions that are inadequate to the problem. So that realization that you are a part of a continuity, hopefully, can actually be quite satisfying because sometimes it's that continuity that's required for success.
Ambassador Newman, on behalf of all of our listeners, a sincere thanks for joining us today.
After this interview was conducted, Reuters reported the Biden administration plans to donate an extra $308 million in humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, bringing the total U.S. aid for the impoverished country and Afghan refugees in the region to nearly $782 million since October. The United States is also providing 1 million additional corona vaccine doses to Afghanistan, bringing the total to 4.3 million doses, according to the White House.
This episode was brought to you as part of a Una Chapman Cox Foundation project on American diplomacy and the Foreign Service. The Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, or ADST, manages the podcast series. If you're interested in exploring a career in the State Department, please visit careers.state.gov to find out more about the practice of U.S. diplomacy. Please visit uccoxfoundation.org or the American Academy of Diplomacy. Please rate and review this podcast so that other folks interested in foreign policy and careers in the State Department can find us. If you have questions or suggestions, please contact me, Ben Reams, at adst.org. Thank you very much.